Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, from vanishing ice to animal die-offs to increasing wildfires, scientists use words like unprecedented and staggering to describe the evident impacts of human-driven climate disruption. Elite media say they take it all very seriously. How far are they from taking it seriously enough? Dar Jamail is a staff reporter at Truthout and author of a number of books, including Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and the forthcoming The End of ICE. We'll talk with him about that. Also on the show, that Donald Trump has found a way to avoid paying federal income tax, and that he and his followers think that's genius, is the opposite of surprising. But what of the response from some in the press that the culprit is a tax code that's too complicated? We'll get some clarity from Richard Phillips, senior policy analyst with Citizens for Tax Justice. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. More than 100 deaths have been reported, but the extent of the damage exacted by Hurricane Matthew on Haiti is not yet known. But with the storm moving towards the U.S., media, too, are moving, leaving in their wake the sort of stories you would predict. Fragile Haiti in the line of fire from Matthew. Impoverished Haiti braces for catastrophic floods as hurricane approaches. And from the New York Times, a list of previous disasters in Haiti, a land all too familiar with hardship. It's hard to wish for more of this sad, static storyline, even as research shows a relationship between the amount of media coverage a disaster receives and the generosity of the response in terms of aid. In a piece for Common Dreams, anthropologist Mark Schuller explains that the relatively high media profile of Haiti's 2010 earthquake came at a price. Quote, "With stories of devastation appearing to many foreign observers as hell on earth, with phrases like state failure often repeated, foreign media coverage also naturalized foreign control of the response." Close quote. Media's disaster narrative, Schuller notes, shapes the response, with all of its messages about who is a hero and whose efforts are ignored. Journalists could find a new approach by listening to Haitian scholars, journalists, and social movements who would prefer support for Haitian-led initiatives, attention to root causes, including neoliberal policies enforced by the U.S., and the participation of local groups in identifying and prioritizing the work to be done. They'd take that over a dozen more sympathetic stories about poor Haiti and its beleaguered people. U.S. media saw a story in the work boycott and street protests by some 6 million women in Poland that led to a reversal of government plans to put through a complete ban on abortion, including in cases of rape or danger to a woman's life. Stories in major U.S. outlets pointed out that Poland's laws are already among the most restrictive in Europe. And they noted the concerns of human rights advocates that the ban would criminalize women and doctors and make women who have miscarriages subjects of suspicion and investigation. It was good to see, but it did make one wonder if those conditions are unacceptable. They are unacceptable, whether they're de jure or de facto, right? But there are numerous places in the United States where women face real, substantive barriers to abortion. A set of maps from Glamour magazine's Abortion in America series illustrates the numerous states with parental notice and consent laws, waiting periods, travel requirements, the states that ban certain procedures or that prevent private insurers from covering abortion or that force counseling on women. American women, in other words, don't need to look afield to find a crisis. It's not clear that the U.S. press corps has heard that message. One indicator, so far there have been zero questions asked about abortion in either the presidential or vice presidential debates. And finally, on the homepage of the New York Times, October 5th, the lead story bears the headline, "Contractor for NSA Charged in Possible New Theft of Secrets." Describing the arrest of Harold T. Martin III, a contractor for the National Security Agency accused of taking classified documents, the homepage teaser reports, The arrest raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, a contractor managed to steal secrets. The main story continues that same emphasis. Quote, the arrest raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, a contractor for the consulting company Booz Allen Hamilton managed to steal highly damaging secret information while working for the NSA. In 2013, Edward J. Snowden, who was also a Booz Allen contractor, took a vast trove of documents from the agency that were later passed to journalists, exposing surveillance programs in the United States and abroad. Close quote. Well, the problem with all this talk about the theft and the stealing of secrets is that while Snowden has indeed been charged by the federal government with theft, along with 2 violations of the Espionage Act, he's been convicted of no crime. Were he to stand trial, he would no doubt try to offer a public interest defense of his actions, as the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe has urged that he be allowed to do, saying that the need to expose government wrongdoing overrode the law against unauthorized release of government documents. Now, the New York Times might think that such a defense would be unsuccessful. No doubt many experts would agree. But it's unusual for the journalist to assume that someone accused of a crime is guilty, in effect taking the role of judge and jury upon themselves. Such an assumption is particularly problematic in this case because the same section of the legal code that's used to charge Snowden with theft of any record, voucher, money, or thing of value also criminalizes whoever receives, conceals, or retains the same with intent to convert it to his use or gain, knowing it to have been embezzled, stolen, purloined, or converted. Well, there's no exception for journalists there, any more than there's an exception for whistleblowers. So if we're going to call Snowden's documents stolen, then journalists often receive stolen records from sources and use them as the basis for stories, as the Times itself has done with documents released by Snowden. In other words, if Snowden is a thief, then the New York Times is a fence. One shouldn't have to point out to journalists that this interpretation of the law is not compatible with the First Amendment or with democracy. When exposing evidence of government crimes is a crime, there's no check on the power of the state. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. New research on attitudes to climate change suggests that people believe they are entitled to their own facts on the matter, even as scientific evidence points one way, only one way, and every day more urgently. Corporate media bear some responsibility. Years of matching every piece of evidence with some statement of doubt or denial, years of placing scientific consensus alongside politicians' folkloric ideas as though they merited the same sort of attention. Even today, media say the words about human-caused climate disruption being a very important problem that requires immediate attention, but it somehow doesn't merit a single question so far in the presidential or vice presidential debates. So are media treating climate disruption seriously, much less seriously enough? We're joined now by Dar Jamail, staff reporter at Truthout and author of, among other titles, The End of ICE, which is forthcoming from the New Press. He joins us by phone from Washington State. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dar Jamail.
Great to be with you.
Let me ask you first about language. I noticed that you use the term ACD, or anthropogenic climate disruption. I take it you find that a more satisfying descriptor than just climate change or certainly global warming.
It's more scientifically accurate, and it leaves no room for error, which, given the climate that those of us reporting about climate disruption are in this country right now, with denial continuing, which is amazing to me, I use it to be as specific and accurate as possible. So when the denialists say climate is always changing, they are factually correct. And this way, it's being disrupted by the introduction of massive amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And it's human-caused, hence anthropogenic. So this way, it just basically leaves no room for error and no wiggle room for the denialists.
And that language can help
as you're saying, really help shape the conversation. I appreciate that. Well, if you tried to understand the United States 2016 approach to anthropogenic climate disruption from media coverage, I think you'd be very confused. You'll find a story in the October 4th New York Times chastising media for going a little crazy just because we passed what the paper called the unhappy milestone, in which CO2 levels that usually drop in September instead stayed above 400 parts per million. You won't, though, find many stories actually going crazy about that fact, which is perhaps why the Times' only example is Vice Motherboard. You'll find stories saying how important it is that the Paris Agreement gets firmed up right away. But then there's an item about how a group of senators wants to declare the burning of forests carbon neutral, because after all, trees grow back. And that's kind of a back pager. You know, now, maybe that confusion just reflects confused policy, but big picture, how far is so-called mainstream media coverage from where it needs to be?
Well, the short answer to that would be, and that's something that people could write several books about, but it's a situation where look at the coverage that you've been exposed to, and everyone right off the top of their head has an idea of what that is, and you just talked about several really, really good examples of that, and let's then hold that up to the fact that there's as much CO2 in the atmosphere now as there was during the Pleistocene period 15 million years ago, at which point the oceans were 80 feet higher. So another way to put that is we've had recent reports that I just wrote about that we published on Monday that came out, one of them showing that the ocean conveyor belt is actually slowing down, which basically is a giant underwater current that transfers energy around the globe and couldn't play a much more critical role in the entire climatological system of the planet. And the study is worried because they're worried about any change of this could, quote, jam the world's ocean circulation. And then another recent report coming out talking about how the temperatures in Earth's oceans are the greatest challenge of our generation and are going off the charts and continuing to warm even as we're moving into fall. So just off the top of my head, a few of these things that are extremely alarming. I mean, all the warning signs are there loud and clear, and they keep getting more intense by the month, and yet mainstream coverage of climate disruption is not keeping apace.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, if we want to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than this 2 degrees Celsius, which we understand is the upper limit, you know, that has been identified, we really can't do any more new digging or drilling. Is that correct? Like zero?
Not only that is absolutely correct. And not only that, but there needs to be ways to start getting carbon out of the atmosphere, because what's already in the atmosphere, according to the head of the UN's Environment Program, who stated this just about a month before the Paris talks last December, she said that if we stopped all CO2 emissions on a dime right this minute, there's already enough CO2 in the atmosphere that we're going to hit 3.5 C by the year 2100. So we need to stop on a dime. Any more drilling and discovering new fields and exploiting them, et cetera, has to be not even considered. And then we need to be finding more ways of sequestration, of getting more carbon out of the atmosphere, meaning more forests, more work on soils, et cetera, but literally causing a negative trend instead of even just breaking even at this point.
See, I just don't feel as though that's really taken as seriously, as taken as meaning what it says. I think for many in the media, keep it in the ground is kind of a slogan, you know, and not really something that is the actual thing that policy has to start from, the square one of it.
Well, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, I think it's just going to take a continuing worsening of the crisis, which we're guaranteed to have, until more global governments start to act. And that's why we're seeing these letters being penned and signed on to by hundreds of the most distinguished climate scientists on the planet, urging governments to act that, look, we're beyond a point of no return. We need to start taking dramatic, serious changes. And there's frustration throughout the scientific community, the people producing these ongoing reports about different aspects of climate disruption, because the reports are coming out, the facts are there. we really have all the information that we need to know, and yet governments are lagging so far behind and pushing through the dramatic policies that we really have to see put into effect.
Yes, I think scientists maybe are even shocked that they can say this is what needs to happen, and politicians will still say, yeah, we feel like we can negotiate a different outcome. You know, it's almost as though they're mindsets that don't mesh. And I guess I think that's where reporters could step into the breach, you know, and talk about the gap between the way politicians talk, just by their nature, and what really has to happen.
I think that journalists at this point, given the situation, are in a position where we are obliged to step in and do that, because scientists can't. They're responsible simply for producing the data and the reports. Their job is not to go out and promote them. That's our job, is to bring attention to these reports and then put the results more in lay language so that readers can understand what they mean. And that's just not being done enough. There's certainly plenty of room where folks can do a lot more of that. And that's what I try to do every month in my dispatch, of put all of these recent reports together over the previous 30 days so that people can see, wow, when you look at this in total and look at the entire web, we are in hot water and we really need to be holding politicians and policymakers' feet to the proverbial fire.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail. You can find his work, including the latest, Scientists Sound Alarm on Climate, But U.S. Still Toys with Skepticism, on truthout.org. Dar Jamail, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In case you somehow managed to miss it, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump acknowledged in the most recent debate that for at least some period of time, he paid no federal income tax, explaining characteristically, "That makes me smart." The statement revealed nothing we didn't know about Trump, but it did raise a few questions for some folks about taxes. Who pays what and why? Richard Phillips is senior policy analyst at Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Richard Phillips.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, the New York Times did some looking at what tax return information they could get about Trump, and a lot of eyes are on the fact that in 1995, he claimed more than $900 million in losses. And this, we're to understand, could be claimed against earnings in future years, such that it's possible his taxes could have been zero for maybe 18 years. Now, no doubt there's much more to it than that. But as a point of information, this whole idea, this basic idea of deducting your losses from your future income, not everybody is allowed to do that.
That's definitely true. And in the most common example for middle-income families, if your house loses value, as a lot of houses did in the 2008 financial crisis, then you don't get to subtract out, you know, the loss of that to your income in a given year, but Donald Trump got to subtract out the losses of his real estate assets going downhill.
Now, the reason for that phenomenon, some would call it a loophole, but there's a reason for it, and I understand that that's because the idea was that it would spur investment or that it would spur job creation, but has that been borne out?
So the whole idea of net operating losses, which is what he experienced doing this, for business makes a lot of sense, because if a business in 1 year makes $100 and the next year loses $200, it seems a little strange to hit them with more taxes when they're not actually making money. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a huge problem with net operating losses to some extent, but I think there's two unique ways that Donald Trump, we know because he's in the real estate industry, Donald Trump is taking advantage of this. One way is that he gets to use a lot of his business losses to cover his own personal income losses. So it's not that, oh, well, within his business itself, he can subtract out the losses from other losses or from other income in his business, but he can actually use that to wipe out his earnings from, say, the money they paid him to be on The Apprentice. And that's something that not all businesses and not all people can do. And then the second unique thing about the real estate industry is that in many cases, and for Donald Trump, we know this is true, that they actually get to take losses based on loans that they are not actually invested in. So in many cases, Donald Trump wasn't putting up all the money to build a building. He was actually taking out very large loans And so he gets to take the losses on those investments, even though he wasn't necessarily making the full investment.
Well, and the rules that allow for that, I think some people may believe, well, yes, they happen to benefit individuals like Donald Trump, but they're in place because they also benefit the economy as a whole. And I guess my question is, does that seem to be the case?
We don't think that these kinds of rules for real estate investors are uniquely helpful to the economy. We think that real estate investors should be treated like any other business or any other businessmen, you know, just be required to pay the taxes they owe and not get these kinds of special tax breaks. So, no, I don't see any reason for us to be disproportionately benefiting the real estate industry. In fact, I think the real estate industry is profitable enough on its own that it doesn't need special tax breaks to enhance it.
Well, recognition that the tax code can favor the wealthy and can favor businesses and particularly real estate has kind of morphed in the public conversation into the tax code is too complicated.
Yeah.
In which light, I was really intrigued by a comment from CTJ's Bob McIntyre, who said the complexity comes from trying to stop people who have found ways around the simplicity. What is he getting at there?
Well, I think people have this sense that it's really easy to figure out what income is. We should just have your income and then multiply it by a rate, and that's all that you have to do. But the problem is that lots of people have figured out ways to make their income a little more complicated. And just using the Donald Trump example, it's actually a little hard to figure out year to year exactly how much Donald Trump is making or losing, and thus what his income is. And so what people like Donald Trump or other wealthy people do is they figure out ways to make what could be income look like losses, or because the tax codes in some cases treats different types of income differently, to shift all of your income into be the less taxed version. The issue is it's inherently hard to kind of get at what income is, and thus it can't be sort of as simple as people want it to be, because the accountants always try to figure out ways to get around them.
Yeah, I'll never forget, no matter how hard I try, a scene in the movie Born Rich, in which Ivanka Trump is describing her father pointing to a homeless man and saying, that guy has $8 billion more dollars than me, you know, because Trump was in debt at the time. And I feel like you can explain about how certain things are on paper and they're not real, but those stories hold a lot of meaning for people, you know, tax code, whatever. This guy was in a hole deeper than a homeless guy, you know, and he made it all back. I think it's kind of hard sometimes to translate this information.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of our hardest tasks in explaining the tax code, and also one of the reasons why the tax code has become so rigged, is because it's become this place for different accountants or tax lawyers to argue. And at that point, it's hard for the American people to kind of engage and figure out, well, what is the loophole and what is the legitimate deduction?
Well, the corporate tax rate has come up in debates, and we've heard offshoring. It's presented by Republicans in the main as being the result of the fact that corporate taxes in the United States are too high. I feel like I've been hearing that for a very long time. It seems like something you ought to be able to say, well, here's the answer to that, relatively. I mean, how much credence do we give this line about corporate taxes being too high and about that being the reason for offshoring?
Well, I think the number one talking point from corporations is that the corporate tax rate is too high, but what they tend to focus on is the statutory tax rate, which is 35%, rather than the effective tax rate that companies are actually paying. And the reality is that that rate is a lot lower than 35%. In fact, a study by Citizens for Tax Justice found that it was around 19% for major profitable companies. So we push that out there and say that, yes, the rate is lower, but it doesn't stop the corporations from claiming over and over again that they're actually paying 35, or the 35 rate is the rate that everyone should be paying attention to.
And I guess if you asked those corporations about paying that lesser rate, they would say that makes them smart. You know, I mean, after all, that is what they have tax lawyers to help with. Well, a lot of the problem, it seems like, that you're laying out has to do not so much with the information not existing, but with a certain kind of opacity, with the inability to get at that information or to use it in an accessible way. So what is this Financial Accounting Standards Board, and how hopeful should we be about that?
Well, so the Financial Accounting Standards Board and also the Securities and Exchange Commission have both been kind of reviewing their standards on what companies are required to disclose in terms of how much they're paying in taxes and how much income they're earning in every country. And so we recently put out a report called Offshore Shell Games, where we kind of took a look at how much companies were paying offshore or how much they're holding offshore. And although we could get some pretty good estimates in terms of showing that Fortune 500 companies have about $2.5 trillion offshore, we were only in many cases able to estimate how much they actually owe in taxes on those things. And actually, we have no sense of where and how much money a given company has in, say, the Cayman Islands versus Germany. And so what we've been trying to push the Financial Accounting and Standards Board to do and the Securities and Exchange Commission to do is require companies to list out the information on a country-by-country basis, things just like income, their tax, how much revenue. And that way, the public and investors would just have a better sense of what's really going on.
And I guess, you know, we would also know what could be invested in the U.S. economy. In other words, kind of what the mass amount is that's missing that could be put to work doing lots of other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a tremendous amount of money they have offshore. I mean, our estimate based on the numbers we do have is that the companies on that offshore stash owe about $718 billion. And that's a lot of money that could go to rebuilding roads, go to investing in childcare and healthcare, and go to all the different priorities that we have.
We've been speaking with Richard Phillips of Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. You can find their work online at ctj.org. Richard Phillips, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
All right, great. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org, and that's the place to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.